Not many women run ballet companies in the U.S. Why is that? Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Lourdes Lopez is the artistic director of the Miami City Ballet, a job she's now held since 2012. And the company's had a lot of success in that time. So why has she been the only woman to lead a major ballet company in a big American city? Lourdes Lopez joins us today. Gould's is not one of Miami-Dade's best-known neighborhoods. It made headlines, though, a few months ago when a 2-year-old was shot to death, apparently caught in a crossfire. Simone Titania Majors and her sister Kiana Majors grew up in Gould's. They still live there, and they want to show a different side of the city. And they did it through photographs. They'll join us as well. But today we're going to start with an update on the trial of the widow of the Pulse nightclub shooter. It's happening in Orlando. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening. In a federal courtroom in Orlando, a criminal case is underway linked to one of the worst mass shootings in the U.S. It's the case against Noor Salman, the wife of the man who shot and killed 49 people at the Pulse nightclub, wounding dozens more. Salman's uncle spoke on the steps of the courthouse this week.
I'm really upset. They're using my niece, and they're throwing her under the bus to cover something else. I know my niece from day one. I've been telling everybody she's innocent.
And that sound provided by the Orlando Sentinel. The defense asked the judge yesterday for a mistrial after we learned that her husband's father had been an FBI informant. The judge denied that request. The defense is expected to finish its testimony this week. We're joined now by reporter Danielle Pryor, part of the team of journalists covering the trial for our sister station WMFE in Orlando. Danielle, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Remind us what happened that evening in the Pulse nightclub.
Well, basically, Omar Mateen opened fire on the dance floor during the very popular Latin night, killing 49 and injuring more than 50 others. And the day after, his wife, Noor Salman, was taken into custody and was interrogated by several FBI agents. And she gave 3 statements, one of which she basically apologized for not saying anything about the shooting, which is how we got to be where we are today.
And what is Noor Salman being charged with?
Sure. She's being charged for aiding and abetting a terrorist organization, as well as obstruction of justice, because those same FBI agents say that she lied to them multiple times in those different statements and during the interrogation process that day.
And what is her defense saying right now?
They're saying that she's innocent. They say that she's naive and that she has a learning disability, that she was abused by Omar Mateen, if not physically, emotionally, that he had affairs behind her back throughout their marriage. And that if she knew that, he was kind of being radicalized, she didn't necessarily know that he was planning the shooting and definitely didn't help him plan the attack.
Now, the shooter, Omar Mateen, communicated with his wife during the night of the shooting. What did they say to each other? What do we know about that communication?
Many different things. And actually, they're kind of the first communications that she didn't delete on her phone, which is something that the prosecution brought up last week, that kind of the text messages and the phone calls start the night before when she tells him to tell his mom, if the mom asks if they can go to mosque that night because it was Ramadan, to tell her that Omar is with Nemo, who was his friend at the time, and that she's at home with the baby. And that's kind of the first communication that was saved on the phone. And the next communications take place when the police standoff is actually happening at Pulse. And she's asking him, "Where are you? I'm worried. Your mom is worried." And he asks, "Have you seen the news?" And she says, "No. What happens?" And then there's a brief bit of time and he basically just says, "I love you." And that's kind of where the communications end that day.
There was this blockbuster revelation that Omar Mateen's father was an FBI informant.
Yes. And this is complicated for a number of different reasons. First of all, Omar Mateen's mother testified last week that she and her family had never met the FBI, that Sadiq did not know the agents that he was speaking to that day. And in fact, not only had he been working with them since 2005, but he had spoken with them in 2013 when they wanted to know if Omar Mateen was in fact being radicalized by ISIS. And on top of that, the prosecution also just told the defense at that time that Sadiq Mateen is under federal investigation because he was actually transferring money at the time of the shooting, well, shortly before, to Turkey and Afghanistan. So that information, as well as the information the previous Thursday that, in fact, Omar Mateen and Noor Salman had never been to Pulse, was very shocking.
So after all of this, but especially the story about the father being an FBI informant, when that comes out, I mean, what happened in court?
You know, not much. I think the jurors at this point are kind of listening to all this different evidence and these shocking revelations that started to be made last Thursday about different testimony. But the defense promptly asked for a mistrial, which was denied by the judge.
Has there been much presence of the victim's loved ones during this trial?
There has been. There have definitely been survivors and victims' families, but there's not been a huge presence in court outside of the media, and I think it's simply that this has been triggering for a lot of people. You know, you have to remember the first week they showed extremely graphic videos and photos of what happened that night, and so I think it's been very hard emotionally when you make people kind of relive the events of that evening.
What can you tell us about the makeup of this jury?
It's mostly women. It's mostly women that, you know, are very not biased when it comes to, you know, Islam and the different events of that night. They didn't necessarily ask people much about their opinions of LGBTQ issues, but it's very female strong.
Now, this could end soon, but which side, can you tell us, which side has made the most powerful case so far?
Honestly, it's for the jury to decide, and they might decide as soon as Wednesday night, believe it or not. But, you know, the prosecution has made a strong case that even though some of the statement has been disproved, that there's a lot of truth to some of the statements that the FBI say that she gave that night, that, in fact, she did go with her husband to Disney Springs and City Place, that, you know, she did help him spend their life savings before the shooting, that she did see him, if not help him, pick out ammunition and guns, but she saw him kind of amassing all of these things. And the defense has done a good job kind of proving that, you know, she didn't necessarily share the same political beliefs. She wasn't political. She wasn't religious in any way, that, you know, she was not radicalized. And that if she knew of his plan, she may not have been able to speak up because of the abuse that went on.
What sort of attention is this trial getting in Orlando? I mean, do you see a lot of national and international media?
There's not. And I think it's simply because the Parkland shooting happened around the same time, and also with the March for Our Lives protests going on in D.C. and throughout Orlando and Florida this weekend. I think the national focus has been on that, but there's been a lot of local coverage, a lot of Orlando and Florida outlets covering the trial.
What about people in Orlando, though? How much attention are they putting on this trial, considering, you know, again, all that you mentioned with the marches and the gun violence, the shooting in Parkland. But, you know, this happened there, and one of the worst mass shootings in U.S. history. What about the people of Orlando? How are they viewing this?
You know, there hasn't been a strong presence necessarily in the courtroom of people outside of, you know, survivors and victims. And I think it's simply that, you know, it was something that has happened in the past, and maybe they want to kind of keep it in the past in the sense that it's been very triggering, and emotionally very hard for a lot of people, I think, to have to relive these events. So I think they wanted a quick trial, which is definitely what's happening, and we'll see what the jury decides very soon.
And
so,
as you said, they may decide by Wednesday.
Absolutely. Wednesday night could be the earliest.
Danielle Pryor is a reporter with WMFE, our sister station in Orlando, covering the Pulse trial, this again of Omar Mateen's wife, Noor Salman. Danielle, we'll keep up on this story. Thank you so much for the update.
Thank you.
All right, still to come, we're going to meet one of the few women running a major ballet company in the U.S. right here in Miami. That's all coming up next on Sundial here on WLRN. Hello and welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Well, you know, a lot of little girls are enchanted by the idea of wearing a tutu, but hardly any grow up to become a professional ballet soloist, let alone run a successful ballet company. Our next guest, Lourdes Lopez, has done all of that, plus founded another dance company and run a dance foundation. She's the artistic director of the Miami City Ballet, and it's such an honor to have you here. Lourdes Lopez, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, Luis, thank you so much for inviting me.
You started, what, at the age of five, right?
I started at the age of five, yes.
Oh my God, I'm trying to think of what was I doing at five.
Me too.
Well, I think I was playing with Legos. I wasn't doing anything as serious as what you were doing. I mean, what was your first experience in ballet?
Well, actually, I started not so much because I liked it, but because I had issues with my legs. And so I had to wear orthopedic boots. So the doctor said one of the things that's really going to help her is to strengthen her legs. And being my parents are Cuban, they said, no gymnastics, no running on the field. We're going to put her in ballet class. And I just I remember just loving it. There was a freedom about it. There was I could lose myself, the music. It was a place where I could really go and be by myself, inside myself. From the age of five, it was really kind of interesting. So my parents were immigrants, and the boots came off at eight. And I remember this distinctly. I was in the kitchen. My dad said, well, we can't really afford these classes anymore unless you really like what you're doing. Are you really enjoying them? And I didn't even hesitate. I just said, I love it. I want to continue. And so that's around the age of eight is really when I became serious.
And you were still in Cuba at the time, right?
No. I left Cuba when I was 2 years old, a year and a half. Yeah, so I was here in Miami. I was raised here in Miami.
So you're doing the ballet here in
Miami. I'm doing the ballet here, absolutely.
I see, okay.
Some wonderful teachers from Cuba, really the pioneers of dance here in Miami, had come from Cuba.
All right, so you had that moment. You tell your dad, you answer your dad, yeah, I want to do this. I'm serious about it. So then what happened?
Well, then they moved me to a Russian teacher, Alexander Negrov, who had a studio in Coral Gables. And really, it was with Mr. Negrov that I learned that this was an entire world that I could belong to. There are stories, there are famous dancers, ballerinas, and these steps had names to them. There was a history, an entire history and community that I could belong to. And so that was at the age of eight. And then at 11, I got my first scholarship with the School of American Ballet. So at that point, I think my parents thought, well, she's under scholarship. She must be good. You know.
And that was in New York City.
That was in New York City. So we went to New York when I was 11. I got a scholarship that actually as immigrants, the beauty of the scholarships is that it allowed me to take my classes here in Miami for free. They paid for my pointe shoes. They paid for my leotards, my tights. Throughout the entire year, and then in the summer, I would go for 6 weeks, and I'd train further in New York. And that's, you know, like everything kind of outside the school academia is expensive. So if it hadn't been for that scholarship, there's no way I would have danced.
And you're going to New York at the age of 11. Who is with you?
My mother. Okay. My mother and my middle sister. But then at 14, I moved to New York by myself with my 19-year-old. And that's really...
Wait. How old were you?
I was 14.
And who did you move to New York with?
With my sister, who was 19. So she went to NYU from Miami-Dade. And we lived there full time.
What was that like? You're 14. You're hanging out with a 19-year-old.
I have to tell you, I am now a mother of two. I have a 28-year-old and a 16-year-old, and I would never ever send them to anywhere by themselves. I just think that there is an opportunity that my parents thought we can't pass this up. We just have to support her. They're offering her a scholarship. She's going to New York. She's doing what she wants to do. She's obviously talented. And let's just see what happens. I mean, it's really extraordinary that they took a chance.
I'm still just wondering what it was like for you as a 14-year-old in New York. I mean, you had to grow up fast.
I grew up very fast. So I think most dancers are pretty mature. I missed it. I was homesick for the first year. The weather was very, very different. It's a very different environment. I spoke Spanish at home. I had my family, my cousins, my sisters. But I was also doing what I loved to do. I mean, I'd, you know, wake up at 7 o'clock and go to school and go take my three ballet classes during the day. And it's what I want to do. And I couldn't do it here at the time. I couldn't do it here.
And you were 16, right? When you joined the New York City
Ballet?
I was
15 and a half when I got in. I got in as an apprentice, 16 when I got in as a union member, as a core member.
Is that unusual?
It's usually about 17, 18. It's usually closer to 18 because there's that growing period. But I was very lucky. Listen, I wouldn't change a thing in my entire life. I would do it all over again. As you know, I had tons of ups and downs and sideways. Nothing about it was linear. But it's very rare to do something that you love to do your entire life. It is, you just don't find that, and I'm very much aware of that.
Again, I'm talking with Lourdes Lopez. She is the artistic director of the Miami City Ballet. All right, so then you are in the New York City Ballet at the age of 16. Well, again, as you said, 15 and a half is when you started. Two really famous choreographers were at the New York City Ballet when you were dancing there. Let me ask you first about working with Jerome Robbins, probably best known to a lot of people for his work on Broadway, most famously West Side Story. What was it like learning from him?
It was extraordinary. You know, we were very much aware that this was a genius American choreographer who'd worked on Broadway and ballet. He was a perfectionist. Jerry was very, very tough on his dancers. He wanted things done a specific way. He looked for perfection, but he got it. I was actually one of the lucky ones that he was very, very nice and very respectful to me. And I learned a lot from him.
And then, of course, one of the other people, the other person that you got to work with, was the founding artistic director of the New York City Ballet and still the most famous American ballet choreographer, though he was born in Russia, Georges Balanchine. What was it like working with him?
Well, I mean, that's it's extraordinary because he is the greatest choreographer of the 20th century. I mean, considered a genius. And to this day, his works are way ahead of their time. He was a mentor, he was a father, he was a teacher, he was a friend. He was someone that I learned not just about dance and ballet, but about life and how to conduct myself, how do I view life in a theater, how do I view myself as a dancer. It was really an extraordinary time, my generation, to have been in the New York City Ballet, because we had two very different geniuses in front of us asking us to do very different things in very different ways. But it was an exciting time, really, as an artist.
How often do you find yourself taking some of the lessons or even saying maybe some of the same things they did when you were teaching?
Every day. Mr. Balanchine would always say, especially to me, because I was so young, he would say, más fuego, more fire, because you knew I was Cuban. And he'd say, what are you saving it for? You know, what's wrong with today? And I find myself looking at the dancers in the studio saying the exact same thing. But, you know, that's a legacy. That's how you pass it down.
Because I obviously I never met him, obviously. And, you know, I'm only going by what I've read and heard, that he did have a reputation for, you know, not being the easiest. Maybe he didn't have that reputation of being the easiest to work with?
Jerome Robbins was not the easiest. Easiest to work. Mr. Balanchine was just a very, very gentle man.
And what was that like, though, with Jerome? What was the challenge?
The challenge was that he wanted his ballets to be done a specific way. So that you had to find who you were as an artist within very strict parameters, his parameters. Where Mr. Balanchine just was, not that he was lax, but he was much more open. He was more interested in what you were going to do with his steps rather than what Jerry wanted you to do, what he wanted you to do with his steps.
Could they still be teaching today? I mean, considering how much the world has changed, could they still be teaching in those styles today?
I think so, because basically what they're doing is they're pulling something out of the artist, and it's what's important is for that artist to grow constantly, to understand more about yourself, because it just adds layers to what you do on the stage. So the minute you have individuals in front of you that are asking more of you and asking different things of you, it's a positive for you.
And so now, like your mentors, you are running, you know, your own ballet.
Now I totally get it.
You know what? I wanted to go, was it 2012 when you took this position?
Yes, yes. It feels like, no, it doesn't feel like yesterday.
Okay. Well, it wasn't that long ago. But when you get this opportunity, and again, because I'm going to ask you about the fact that, again, you're one of a few women who are in this position.
Yeah.
What was that like, that first day? You come in, how do you make that transition?
It was terror because the transition happened, I'm sure you remember, kind of it played out in the press, and it was not a fun transition. It was a very, very difficult one. It always is when you have a founder who decides to leave. Things happen, and they've built this company. It's their baby. So that departure, that transition, is never an easy one. And so I marched in basically an unknown. I was this well-known dancer. I had worked in the art form in the field my entire life, on the administrative side, but never as an artistic director. So I was basically an unknown. But I walked in, and I just thought to myself, I need to fit into this place. In other words, I can't assume that I understand them. I can't assume that I understand the company. I can't assume that I understand the dancers. I have to open myself up to learn what it is that makes them unique. And I think that kind of that sense of wanting to get inside of them to understand the company and the community of the company and the feel of the company is work to my benefit, as opposed to someone coming in from New York saying, okay, let me show you how it's going to be done. It doesn't, you know, it doesn't feel organic. It doesn't feel real.
But even though you were coming from New York, I mean, you lived here, so you weren't a stranger, right?
I mean, no, the community felt very familiar because I speak the language. I was raised here. So geographically, I, you know, walked around, well, that's 8th Street and that's, you know, Crandon Park. And so there were things I understood and that I remembered, but I'd been 40 years in New York. When I left in 72, now you know how old I am, if you're good at math, when I left in 72, there was nothing in Miami. There was nothing, you know, which is why I left, because I wanted to dance and I couldn't do it here. When I came back, you have what we used to call El Parque de las Palomas, which is Biscayne, now has, you know, Botero statues, and you have museums, and you have galleries, and you have studios, and you have New World Symphony, and you have the Arched, and none of that was here. So it's, in that respect, it was exciting to come back, but I was the outsider.
I can do the math on that number because that's the year I was born, so that's okay. That's why I can do the math on that number. But you know what? The other thing, too, I was wondering is that when you came in, so you're trying not to, you don't want to be the outsider who's demanding, you have to understand the group that you're working with. But I also wonder, you know, again, being a woman and one of only a few women in this position, did people look at you differently? Or was it, were people excited, like, finally?
No, you know what? I think it's interesting. The whole female issue really started about 2 years later. I want to say nationally, in terms of understanding that in the dance world, in the arts, on the administrative side, there were very few women who held executive leading positions. What's interesting for me is that the Miami City Ballet Board never even went there. They were just looking for someone who they felt could really take this company to its next level, to its next artistic phase. And that's really how I viewed my place, or how I always view my position, which is, it's not about being a man or a woman. Is it, am I doing the best job that I can do? Am I suited for that job? And then you just go for it.
Why has it just been mostly men? Why is it seems like there's this boys club or something?
Louis, I think I have my views on that. I'm not a doctor, you know, or a social scientist. So it's just a gut feeling. Men, when boys start to take ballet class, there are very few of them are actually interested in dancing. So the minute you're a young man and you're interested in dancing, you get a scholarship. That's not true for women. The rest of us have to work very hard. There's, you know, massive competition. And it's just by the nature of the art form that attracts more women than men. So I think the minute you get a scholarship as a male dancer, there's already this sense of, you know, I'm good. There's a confidence that's built at a very, very early age. The other is because the art form is predominantly women. Women are always in the theater dancing most of the ballets. So when you get to around 11 o'clock and it's the last ballet of the evening, most of them are women on the stage, and the men in the company have gone home. They're just not as physically active. They're not in as many ballets. And I think that gives you the edge on being able to do other things like study, read a book, meet with someone. And so those two things, I think, contribute to the fact that you tend to have men in these leadership positions. I also hear that board members, because they feel that men can raise more money than women. Now, I don't think that's true, but it is a perception.
Do you see yourself as a role model then, considering your success?
I hope I see myself as a role model for running a ballet company that that has kept its legacy of its founder, and which is really the Balanchine and the Robbins repertory, that has increased the repertory, that has increased audiences, that is respectful to the artists that are part of the company, and to show that, you know, less about being a woman, but more about being a, you know, a real artistic director, really what Balanchine was to me.
And by the way, you know, do you see that that case with the having, again, more women in ballet than men? Do you see that in modern dance too? Is it still
it's
more
the same? Yeah, it's the same thing in modern dance. It is changing now. Women are now stepping up to the plate, and maybe they're deciding they can have it all. They can have a family. They can run a company. I don't know, but I think it's the opportunities are there, and if you feel that you can be an artistic director, you should go for it. It's a wonderful job. It's a hard one.
I cannot let you go without asking you about, you know, we think about everything that's happened over the last year and a half, couple of years, in this Me Too movement, and how it's impacted so many different industries. What about in ballet? What about in dance?
It's absolutely, it's impacted dance, and it's about time, because I think for in most parts, dancers really tend to be very, excuse me, very quiet. We don't speak. We speak with our bodies. And so it's important for dancers to understand that, you know, that they need to be treated as human beings and as artists. And this type of kind of view of that you keep hearing during the Me Too environment is really, there's no place for that in dance. There's no place for that in anything, but specifically in dance. So I'm actually thrilled that it's actually gotten to us.
Again, I'm talking with Lourdes Lopez. She is the artistic director of the Miami City Ballet. And again, when we look at the major ballet companies across the country, one of only a few women in a major city running a ballet company, and has had a great deal of success in just a few short years. She says it doesn't feel like yesterday, but 2012 was a while ago. So, you know, I wanted to get to like the New York City Ballet. The Miami City Ballet has a reputation for its productions of ballets choreographed by Balanchine. How do you interpret that today? Because reading about you, is you're looking for not gimmicks, you're looking for a way to interpret, you know, the music and the dance for the modern audience. And I'm wondering, how is the audience changing, and how do you have to change with it?
You know, every community is different. And I think ballet companies, dance companies have to absorb the DNA of their community and try to figure out what they want to see. And that's hard. That's very difficult. Also, I'm not a choreographer, so I have to look for these choreographers. But I go back to what I've always believed, which is great art is great art. And so you can be listening to Mozart, or you can be listening to the Beatles, or to Eric Clapton, or you could be looking at something by Van Gogh, or by Richard Serra. Great art is great art. It's going to move you. It's going to speak to you, because that's what it's supposed to do. And that's why I say I don't look for gimmicks, because I don't think gimmicks, in the end, say anything. I think they're just kind of, you know.
But do you feel that you have to, you know, I mean, how do you define that evolution? Because you're thinking about new audiences. You think about the world we live in today and how we consume anything, entertainment and information. And so with these newer audiences, the younger audiences especially, what do you have to do to win them over? Is it still just stay to the traditions? Or, and again, without avoiding the gimmicks, but you have to do something different,
it's
right?
One of the reasons that I reimagined the Midsummer Nights, George Balanchine's Midsummer Nights, and I was given the permission by the trust to reimagine it. It's a work he choreographed in, I want to say, the early 1958, and had only been, it took place, it's the Shakespeare story, takes place in Greece, and you know, kind of old fashioned with wigs, and the men were wearing skirts and tights and shoes. And I brought in an artist to reimagine it in a different place, in a different space, and with different costumes. And it was very, very successful. They used projections, and it actually brought in a very different audience. So you want to do that, but again, I felt it was in full respect to the work, the original work by George Balanchine. In other words, the choreography stayed the same, the narrative stayed the same, the music was the same, but I just changed where that place, where that story took place. You have to be open to things. You have to have taste. You have to, I think, have a deep respect, not necessarily in this order, but have a deep respect for tradition and for where you came from. Because then at that point, you can break it. So that's on the artistic side, what you get on stage. You also want to communicate differently, because these young people, there's a lot of social media, so you want to be able to communicate and commune with them in a very different way than you used to, say, in the 70s or even in the 80s.
You talked about, too, a moment ago, about understanding, you know, the audiences in your area, obviously the people here in South Florida who are your audiences. What have you figured out about who they are and what they are looking for?
Well, this is what's interesting, because we have four different markets, Miami City Ballet. So we dance in Miami, we dance in Palm Beach, we dance in Broward, and we also dance in Naples. So in Miami, believe it or not, they love the full lengths. They love the full lengths. Don Q, Romeo and Juliet, Swan Lake, Coppelia. You give it to them, and that's one of the reasons I program it at full length every season. In Palm Beach, that's not the case. In Palm Beach, they actually like more contemporary works. We had one recently, our first postmodern work by a choreographer, Brian Brooks, One Line Drawn. That is, it's a movement I haven't even seen. Right? I was astounded. And yet, they loved it in Palm Beach. And they loved it here in Miami, the younger audiences. So I think as long as it's good and as long as you're giving them an experience, that's, for me, that's what counts.
And you're about to premiere the new show, well, famous Balanchine Ballet, Apollo. It's coming up next week.
Yes, it's coming up second week, April 13th, here at the Arsch. It's program four, so it's Apollo by George Balanchine. And then we have Concerto DSCH by Alexei Ratmansky. And then La Valse by George Balanchine. It's a wonderful, wonderful program of two great Russian choreographers.
Let me leave you with this. Legacy. What is the legacy that Lourdes Lopez wants to leave in dance, in ballet, and you know, just maybe for the community?
You know, a very hard question, because I don't go through my life thinking of what legacy. I think that's for others to figure out after I'm gone. I'm just here because I really feel that dance is an empowering, transformational art form. I really do. I think it, more than any art form, it can speak to everybody if you allow it to. And it's changed my, it's changed my life every day. So I want to keep on doing it and keep on sharing it as much as I can and let others figure out whether I've left a legacy behind or not.
Lourdes Lopez, again, Artistic Director of the Miami City Ballet. It's a pleasure to finally have gotten you in the studio. Thanks so much.
It was great to be here. Thank you.
All right. And we'll have more information, by the way, about that show coming up again in later in April. We'll have that up on our Facebook page after the program. Coming up, we're going to meet a pair of sisters who will introduce us to the community of ghouls through photography. That's all coming up next on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. The Ghouls community is one of the oldest in Miami-Dade, going back to the beginning of the last century. But the South Dade community has had its challenges over the years, including most recently the tragic shooting death of a toddler caught in crossfire. Simone Titania Major has spent her life in Ghouls. She won a Night Arts Challenge last year to photograph the barbecue chefs and entrepreneurs of Ghouls. And her sister Kiana Major recorded the sounds, some of which you're hearing right now, of them cooking in these huge barrels early in the morning, like ridiculous hours. Their work goes on display at the South Miami-Dade Cultural Arts Center in Cutler Bay this weekend. And Simone and Kiana Major join me now in studio. Thank you so much. Great to have you here. And by the way, congratulations.
Thank you so much for having us, Louis.
Yes. All right. You know what? First of all, we may not know. It is one of the older communities, but it's not one that's discussed a lot. But how do you describe, to people who don't know Goulds, how do you describe Goulds?
Yes, so Goulds is definitely rich in culture. If you've never been there before, I suggest that you definitely come on down and get some barbecue from our local vendors there. You'll definitely get a sense of community. You'll get a sense of excitement. We love to party there. There's always a jam going on. And for those people that don't know what a jam is, it's pretty much a neighborhood party, almost like a block party, and they have it almost every week. And of course, you'll be able to definitely see these barbecue vendors with their amazing grills and delicious food.
You know what, Kiana, I was thinking about, you know, it, again, unfortunately, a community that is in the news but never for something good, or seldom for something good, and that's a hard part. But what is it people don't know about or don't get about Goulds that it's not in the news?
What they really don't get about is that it's actually really beautiful. It's a quiet place when there's nothing going on, like what you see on the news. It's pretty much just birds. There's all different types of animals. There's all different types of trees, and just like kind of a rural tranquility that you don't get in the city. And there's also just like you said, the history about it, which is amazing. You know, it was founded by Arthur Mays, and he pretty much just brought the entire land and wanted it to be for, you know, underprivileged Black people in Miami. And it's really cool to know about that as well.
All right. Let's talk about this project the two of you have put together. And again, you know, this is a Night Arts Challenge winner. Simone, I remember I had the chance to talk to you some months back, I think after the announcement of the Night Arts Challenge listings. And, you know, you were at the time, you were trying to figure out what you were going to do with something. And you were driven by these folks out barbecuing lots of times. You thought nothing of it.
Right.
And then what was the inspiration? What was the click moment, like, hey, there's something here.
Yeah, so definitely one of the situations that brought me to doing this photo series, The Unvoiced Community, Barbecue Men, Women of Goulds, was just being tired of the violence and the negativity that was going on in my neighborhood. And so I decided to find peace, to find something positive. And my sister Kiana and I, we decided to just go and try and figure out what would be the best option to showcasing the positivity, the great things, the sense of community that we have in our community. And so it just kind of sparked me. I used to work at the Marriott. I tell the story all the time. And I got off of work maybe around 12 or 1 o'clock, and just driving home religiously. This is something I did almost every day, drive home around 1 a.m. And I would always see these empty lots, just empty lots late at night. And you would see a cloud of smoke arising from this empty lot with a spotlight behind it. And it's very intriguing to see. And one day I just decided to, you know, stop off and talk to these people and try and figure out exactly what was behind the smoke. And to my surprise, it was the barbecue vendors. And it just decided, you know, it just came to be a beautiful story that grew inside of me and grew into the community and my sister as well.
How often are these folks out there?
So every weekend.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it is a process. They have to prepare throughout the week, but they start setting up shop Friday through Sunday. And they're there maybe 8 o'clock at 8 o'clock at night to about three, four o'clock in the morning.
So you decide that there's a story here that you want to tell. You told it with your camera.
With my camera.
And Kiana, you recorded all this sound of these conversations and these folks just working.
Yeah, I thought it would be really interesting to capture just the soundscape of, you know, just the sound of the meat hitting the grill, the sound of the Jennies running, the sound of just, you know, community people coming to talk to one another, and like the positive greetings that you have when, you know, two people who haven't seen each other in like 5 days are like, oh, hey, man, what's up? I haven't seen you in a while. How's your kid? What's up, baby? Like that kind of like fun thing that you don't really, you know, see or you don't really hear unless you live in the neighborhood.
Who are these barbecue entrepreneurs, Kiana? I mean, how do you describe these folks?
I mean, these people are just religiously just trying to, you know, make extra money to support themselves. They're trying to, you know, do other things to keep themselves from being dragged down by some of the negativity that is in the community. So they're just, you know, people who love to cook, people who love to see other people happy, and then people who love to make other people happy with their food.
All right, so Simone, what's it like when you and your sister show up and you've got your camera and she's got this microphone she's sticking in their face. I mean, you know, it's from everything I'd seen, it looked like they were very open to sharing a lot with you.
Right, very much so. And my sister had to give me quite a few pep talks to get out of the car and go and talk to these vendors.
Okay, wait, hold on. Kiana, what was the pep talk like?
The pep talk was just like, you know, these are your people. You know these people. These people have known our family for generations pretty much. And, you know, you should just go and talk to them. It's like talking to your cousin. It's like talking to your uncle. It's like talking to family.
Right. Okay, that worked for me, so... So she had a pep talk you into doing it.
Right, exactly. And, you know, I'm so glad she did, because when we went to meet these barbecue vendors, they were, wow, I mean, so open, so humble. And they were excited for us to be there. They wanted to be documented over, you know.
What was one really surprising story?
One surprising story, Mama Dukes. Oh, my gosh.
Okay, wait, Mama Dukes?
Mama Dukes.
Okay,
yes,
who's Mama Dukes?
She has an orange truck. She's okay. Always right on Alapata, which is right in Goose off of 217. So you have to make sure you come down there and meet her.
All right.
She's an amazing woman. And this is one of the reasons I named it Barbecue Men and Women, because women are doing it as well. And to go back to the night that I met her, you know, just walking up to her and her daughter, asking if I can take photos, if I can document them, she said, absolutely. Absolutely. And not only did she do that, but she also greeted us with some Southern iced tea, which mm-hmm. made it all better. And so we began conversation. We began to take photos and the camera began to almost become invisible. We didn't even see it there. We started to build this relationship. And I actually just left her house. We were very close now. And she'll be at the event Saturday cooking as well.
And what's her specialty?
Her specialty, okay.
Well, besides the tea. Besides the tea,
yes. Collard greens, hands down. Okay. Her barbecue ribs are tender. Her chicken is juicy. So pretty much everything on her menu. She also does, on the side, blue crabs for anyone who loves that. But mainly barbecue. But her collard greens and ribs are absolutely amazing.
You know, I'm wondering, too, is like, because one of the things that we talked about before yeah. is that, look, this isn't like... They just set up out there. They just went out there and then just started doing this. And so, I mean, there's that element of like, well, is it really allowed? But they're just doing it and everybody just, this is just part of life.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. So again, I oftentimes say that they're always on a lot in Ghouls. And it's not like, you know, they were granted these lots. It's just undeclared positions that they mm-hmm. have every weekend. They have to make sure they're there at a certain time so that no other barbecue vendor will take that location. And, you know, it's just an amazing experience to be a part of. And I've learned so much from these barbecue vendors. I learned so much culture. I've learned that we have tradition. And as you spoke about, there is a lot of violence that goes on in Ghouls. And to be able to be a part of something great, to be a part of artistry, to be a part of entrepreneurship mm-hmm. and community is just such an amazing thing. And I'm just so thankful that they even allowed me to enter their space and to document it and tell the rest of Miami about it.
Again, I'm talking with Simone Titania Major and Kiana Major, and both of them working on this really incredible project, which is on display, by the way, at the South Miami-Dade Cultural Arts Center in Cutler Bay this weekend. We'll have more information on our website. You could find us on Facebook, WLRN Sundial. And again, this was a Night Arts Challenge winner from last year. And again, it's these beautiful photographs and this audio that's been collected, again, about these barbecue entrepreneurs, these men and women out there in the community of Goulds on the weekends, late at night into the early morning hours. Some fascinating work to check out. And again, we'll put some of those photos, by the way, up on our website. I did get one beautiful shot that we posted up on Facebook and on Twitter. Simone, it was this one, it was like a side view of one of the barrel grills.
Right.
Black and white, a lot of black and white, mostly black and white, I believe, right?
Yes, correct.
And, you know, just the way that you capture it, all of this happening at night, the food just sizzling up there on the grill, you can almost smell it, even though it's a photograph.
Yes, absolutely. You can almost smell it. And the way that I wanted to approach these pictures are to definitely, you know, go the more authentic route, because these people are definitely authentic. And I find that black and white is one of the truest forms of photography. And so I decided to go that route. And I wanted to, you know, to kind of be a little invasive and take these pictures that, you know, are displaying the food. You know, I mean, I understand there's a lot of vegans and vegetarians out there, and please don't be mad at me, but I wanted to show the beauty that meat does have as well, you know, and the love and tenderness that these barbecue vendors are putting into it, the hours of work that they have to put into seasoning the food, to lighting up the grill, to attaching the grill to their car and bringing it out to the location. And so I wanted to make sure that I captured that and to be able to bring that to Miami, so that we can appreciate the barbecue a little bit more and the entrepreneurship that they bring to our community.
Kiana, I mean, you have all these folks out here on the weekend doing the barbecue. That means there are a lot of folks out to eat.
Yeah.
I mean, what? Tell me a little bit about the atmosphere on the weekend. Is this just on Friday nights, Saturday nights?
It's Friday and Saturday nights.
Okay. I mean, it sounds like this festival, it seems, every weekend. I don't know. To tell me what's going on.
I guess you could say, yeah, it's like a small little block party of a festival where people just kind of are coming home from work or, you know, and they want something to eat and they just want to sit down and take 5 minutes and enjoy and relax and catch up with a few friends. It's really just a nice space to, you know, eat food and talk.
What did you, I mean, look, this is something obviously you've known about, you've seen this there for a long time, mm-hmm. but now you really paid attention to it. Now you went in to really document it. What did you learn about your community you didn't know before?
That's a good question. Me personally, I didn't really know much about my community until I really, really went into it with Simone and her help to get to know other people that weren't just, you know, my immediate family, and getting to know all these people who knew me before I didn't even know, you know, who they were.
By the way, you guys were third generation.
Yeah, yeah, third,
exactly. Family
of
Goulds,
yes,
right?
Correct. Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, what did you learn about your own history, your own family traditions, I guess, you know, again, going back three generations?
Well, I guess one funny story is when there's a woman who always visits the barbecue stands, and her name was Minnie or Mimi, and she told a story on how my oldest aunt won prom queen when they went to high school together, and I didn't know that, and I thought that was really amazing, and I'm like, wow, you know, these stories that these people have that I've never been told by any of my, you know, my 10 uncles and aunts,
right,
about their lives, and it's pretty cool. I was like, man, you know, I could have been prom queen.
And it's, by the way, it's not just that you've lived in Goulds now, it's three generations, but in that house.
In that house.
The same house.
Right. Yeah.
That's so rare in yeah. South Florida. So, I mean, there's got to be a lot of stories that just, you know, family, from family to family, just passed down.
Sure, absolutely.
Still live there.
Absolutely. Yeah, so again, I mean, like you said, it's been years that we've been living in that house, and that was my grandmother's house. That house was actually built. My father and his sisters saw the house being built. And so to be able to live there, it just makes me feel so enriched with culture and just my family background, and to really look into what makes me as a person, what makes us special, and what drives us to be where we are now and today's time. And so it's just, it's pretty exciting. It's pretty exciting to see. Mm-hmm.
I wondered, you know, when you had the chance to go back and talk to these folks, you photographed and recorded and showed them and let them see and hear what you had done. I wonder what their response was to that. Kiana, let me start with you. What are some of the things you heard?
Some of the things, they were just really happy to see, you know, positive aspects of the community being put out to the rest of the world and to the rest of, you know, Miami, that, you know, they're not just a community of violence, not just a community of negative things, but positive things with positive people doing, you know, amazing things to just trying to, you know, live life in a uplifting way.
And Simone, what about you? What are some of the things that maybe caught you off guard a little bit about some of the stuff that they had, were feeling when they saw those photographs?
Well, definitely. Wow. And this is a bit difficult for me to say as well. So being able to document them the first night that I met them I didn't really know who was involved and, you know, who was around them. But at this time, I've been made aware that one of the vendors, somebody in their family has passed away, and I have photos of them. And it, for me to show them that photo, it kind of brought them back to a memory. It kind of brought them back, and they were excited that they had somebody document that portion of their life, that person that was around them, that person that showed up to their barbecue truck and grill every weekend. So it was pretty cool, because capturing photos can capture time in a sense. And so being able to do that for them, really brought peace and joy to my heart.
That is lovely. Yeah. You have this display coming up, but what's next? What's the next big thing? What's the next inspiration?
Yeah, so a lot of people have been asking that. This current project has taken us about 2 years. So maybe a little break after that, but we definitely want to continue to showcase and document things in GOOS. As Kiana mentioned, Arthur Mays has started up GOOS, and we want to do a little research into that and maybe hit up the Miami History Museum and get some information and try and document GOOS and put it in a museum or a library, at least a book. You know, we want to at least be on the map and just, you know, be heard.
I get the feeling Kiana's going to pep talk you into not taking a break and getting to work on that as
Actually,
soon as possible.
Actually, I was thinking about that as she was saying it.
See? I knew it. Why did I know that? Again, Simone Titania Major and Kiana Major, and they have this, this display coming up at the South Miami-Dade Cultural Arts Center in Cutler Bay. It's this weekend. We'll have the information on our website. Beautiful photographs, fascinating sound of these barbecue entrepreneurs, these men and women who've been doing this for a long time on the weekends, just out there. And as I said before, just looking at those photographs, not just beautiful, but also you can almost taste the food. It looks absolutely amazing. But what an amazing piece. Simone, Kiana, I really appreciate the time. Congratulations again, and thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
All right, again, we'll have information on that on our website. You can find us again on Facebook, WLRN Sundown. Have a wonderful day. I'm Luis Hernandez. We'll talk to you tomorrow.